So thanks for letting me or inviting me to share. I really appreciate the opportunity to think about my relationship with food and surgery in particular and present that for you guys. It helps me organize my thoughts, and I hope you guys get something out of it. So I've got a complex relationship. It's sort of physical, emotional, and psychological, as we all do with food. I identify and qualify as Alex, compulsive eater. Bulimic, in remission, thankfully. Also, come to discover I'm a restrictor and a sugar addict. So I'll focus on my relationship with food and compulsive eating. I consider OA a crucial pillar in my recovery, and I also identify as an alcoholic, as an addict, and as an adult child of alcoholics. So I'm attending AA meetings and adult children meetings here face to face and online. And I'm working the steps simultaneously in AA, ACA, and OA at the moment. I'm not working, fortunately, so I'm able to do that. So I'm sort of juggling books left, right, and center, but it's all sort of moving forward in one sort of recovery kind of vibe for me, which is sort of working, which is good. I identify as a transgender man as well. So I was born female, but always considered myself male. I've been on testosterone for 20 years and I've had some reassignment surgery. I like to identify as trans to sort of claim my seat, just generally. And often people come up to me after meetings and talk to me about stuff or they identify, you know, with the queer community somehow or other. And also because I'm proud of my journey and the resilience and the opportunities that being trans has sort of afforded me. So also because my experience of gender dysphoria is not, well, it's inseparable from my journey with substances and the first one being food as a child. So my journey in OA, I've been attending online OA meetings for about 6 months. So a couple of weeks ago, I sort of consolidated all my online meetings into a Google Calendar, which has revolutionized my life, and changed it all into the Australian time zones and everything. So it's awesome. So it means that I can target the groups that most appeal to me. So I'm focusing on special interest groups in OA, and they are the weight loss surgery and 100 pounders, anorexic and bulimic groups, LGBTQ groups, body image, relationships and sexuality groups, and also the secular and free thinker groups. So I'm really hammering the groups while I can. I'll have to return to work in January after my shoulder is better, but you know, getting most of it while I can. So I've been abstinent from overeating for 15 days now. I've got a sponsor who I communicate with through a WhatsApp group. No, just through WhatsApp rather. And I think I originally found her through a body image WhatsApp group and just hit her up and asked if she would be my sponsor. And it's sort of been this magical kismet kind of situation. She's kind and she's wise and she encourages me to be gentle with my efforts but also with my language. So she's sort of toning it down, which is excellent. And I don't feel like that's undermining my effort at all. It's just keeping me realistic and keeping me on track, which is really good. I heard a fellow overeater talking about sponsorship like a lineage kind of thing, and they discussed the importance of having a sponsor who's got a sponsor who's got a sponsor kind of thing. And I instantly thought of the Karate Kid and and his teacher, Mr. Miyagi. And I thought, well, I hope that through working the program with the sponsor, that I'll learn the practical skills, but also the spiritual vibe that she's got to teach, and that will enhance my recovery. Practically and spiritually, so I can pass that on when I've done the steps myself. So I understand that importance of having something worthwhile to pass on and, you know, hopefully improving on it, you know, with each generation of sponsorship, you'd hope. So I've got an action plan that I struggled to find a copy of like a template to copy of an action plan. So I do this massive kind of thing with all my fellowships in it and hopes and dreams for the rest of my life. But it's based on the 9 tools, and I'll review that periodically. I've got a dignity of choice food plan, which is based on the advice of my dietitian and also the bariatric surgeon that I'm seeing every 3 months now. So, you know, I've got a range of things I can choose to have for breakfast, choose to have for lunch, and also dinner time I'm still getting like pre-prepared meals because I'm just not organised enough. I haven't got the time or the headspace to be doing that. So I've just sort of outsourced that, and that's okay. Earlier in my recovery, I had outsourced breakfast, lunch and dinner because I couldn't trust myself to weigh things and measure things a little too much. So I just had them bring me food, and that helped me to get a sense of portion control. And so I've weaned myself off the breakfast and weaned myself off the lunch, and so now I'm just on the dinners, and that's just a laziness dinner. All right, so in the beginning, I'm also doing the Footsteps 15-week, 12-step intensive, but hopefully that'll get me through the steps because we don't have OA face-to-face here, so that's the next best thing. So, you know, if I can get up at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'll be doing that. So the beginning with me with food. So I was born in Tasmania, which is a little island down in south Australia, and I was the first of 4 children. So from as young as I can remember, I thought I was a boy. I remember insisting on attending a dress-up day in kindergarten as Noddy, who is like a English cartoon character. That was just who I thought I was. So it wasn't that I thought I wanted to be a boy. I actually thought I was one. I changed to a private co-educational school when I was 7 years old, and I remember following this kid called Theo into the boys' toilets, and he probably turned around and told me I wasn't supposed to be in there. Also, I remember being asked on the first day of school there that what I'd like to be called, because there was already a Katie in the class, and I distinctly recall this little pause where I felt like saying Benjamin or Robert or something like that. But it just sort of, I just said, just call me Kate. So I feel like I've been on the brink of coming out all through childhood, you know, but just didn't have the words or the understanding for what was going on really with me. So I was acutely aware of the issue from as young as I can remember, and I attempted to behave like I was expected to. So I was acting out wherever it was tolerated. So I was like the only girl in the football team just before high school, that sort of thing. Like I was sort of did as much as I could. And that sort of kept me sane to an extent. During primary school, I became very, very friendly with the tuck shop lady. I'd spend a lot of my recess and lunch times just hanging out with her and hiding out there and eating my feelings. So she would kindly leave me the cake mix bowl from when she'd make cake, and I'd just lick that, and, you know, lick the spoon, lick the bowl. And so I sort of had a steady flow of food from early on. So in high school, I sort of had a chunky, chubby, athletic kind of build, and I would sort of hide in big jumpers and stuff, and I'd frequently get in trouble for wearing sports gear, like because that was a tracksuit rather than the skirt that I was supposed to wear. So I was basically hiding in the fat, and I used humour to sort of deflect attention from myself and was a bit of a class clown. So at 16, I discovered bulimia as a means to weight. Well, I thought I invented it, actually. So that was my weight loss strategy. And initially it was very effective, but it spiraled out of control. And I'd cycle between restriction and binging and purging, and that persisted until I was about 24. So I left home at 17, and I discovered party drugs as a means of distraction and escape from what was going on for me. I discovered my drug of choice, which was an anesthetic that was inhaled, and it became a really damaging and expensive obsession for me for 15 years. So I was in deep denial at the time about my gender, and I used food and drugs to sort of stuff my feelings at that time. So at, around that time, I sort of was emotionally and physically attracted to women, and I felt there was a weight of expectation for me to be straight. So there was the sexuality stuff as well as the gender stuff. So I started an
minutes has passed.
Thank you. Thank you. Started an extremely toxic and damaging relationship with a guy for 6 years, and my eating sort of went into overdrive and the weight sort of piled on. The bulimia wasn't keeping up anymore. And I feel like I was attempting to protect myself and again hiding the weight. So at age 25, I went through an identity crisis and came out as trans. So I changed my name and just promptly took off and moved to Queensland. So the stress and the conspicuous nature of gender transition sort of pushed me further into the food. So I just became bigger and bigger. I'm not very tall. I felt very bulky, and that was sort of double-edged sword. Like, I hated myself, but also I felt more significant walking down the street. So I started testosterone, which gives you the appetite of a teenage boy, and I booked in for a chest reconstruction. And at that time, I knew that losing weight would enable the surgeon to do a better job cosmetically, but there was that pressure to lose weight just made me eat more. So I had my surgery at my highest ever weight, which was 114 kilos or 250 pounds. So I continued eating at that time, and the bulimia sort of just faded out, went into remission. So I was still hiding the fat, really. In 2008, I found a surgeon who was willing to do further reconstructive surgery, so MOA surgery, as they call it, which wasn't available in Australia at that time. And he said I'd have to lose weight in order to do that. So I promptly got a lap band without any counselling, without any dietitian support. And it was effective. And I lost weight down to 95 kilos or 200 pounds. So I returned to that surgeon and I told him that I was ready to go ahead and have the surgery, but that also I wanted to have a child. And he was very confused by that notion. And he withdrew his offer to perform the surgery, thinking that I was obviously confused as well. I'd always wanted a child, and I had consulted fertility specialists and endocrinologists and ethicists from 2002 when I first began my transition in testosterone, and nobody could tell me the effect that testosterone would have on my fertility. So I shelved the idea because I was single and in active addiction and also not financially or emotionally in a position to start a family. In 2009, I met a woman and got married. And I probably got my act together. So I stopped taking drugs. I completed an accelerated uni degree. I worked two jobs, had a successful business, and started looking after myself, basically. So marriage really suited me, and I could finally see a pathway to the life and the family that I wanted. So my wife didn't have any eggs left at that point, so I stopped testosterone and commenced doing IVF. So I was donating embryos to her, and that was unsuccessful for 3 years. And we had a final cycle returning the embryos to myself just when we're out of money, basically. We'd come to the end of our effort. And I became pregnant and gave birth by C-section to my son in October 2013. So during the pregnancy, I had the fluid removed from my lap band because I didn't want to be vomiting and all that sort of stuff. So it was actually the healthiest I've ever been under my own steam. So it was sad when I look back because I couldn't look after my body for myself, but it was great that I was able to look after it to grow my son. Like, I sort of took that pretty seriously. Unfortunately, the stress of the process led to the end of the marriage, and my ex-wife and I now share custody of my son. So after 10 good years, the lap band spontaneously developed a port site infection, and I had to have it removed. And I slowly started gaining weight again. I'd been stable at about 100 kilos for a long time. So I decided to have a gastric bypass. So I was confident that the surgery would go well because I had relatively modest weight of only 100 kilos or 220 pounds and a relatively young age, only 44. So I thought I'd just sail through and that'd be that, be back at work and everything would be good. Unfortunately, I had a massive post-surgical arterial bleed and I was in ICU for 3 days and had like 14 bags of blood, and it was really touch and go and not very good. So I felt pretty silly that I'd underestimated the risks of surgery, and that I felt sort of weak that I'd chosen to have surgery rather than just make lifestyle changes. But my life experience was that I couldn't do any better than what I had done. And if I was going to lose weight, I really did need the tool of surgery. So I had a good, I've had a good experience since with the bypass, with not very much dumping. I've got adequate restriction. I've had minor nutritional deficiencies, like I only needed B12 injections, and that's it. So I see my surgeon every 3 to 6 months and have regular bloods, and I have a dietitian and a psychologist that I see as well. So I've come to realize that I couldn't have achieved a healthy weight without surgery, and that it's added years to my life and also to the quality of life. I've got no more varicose veins. I don't have gout. I don't have hypertension. I don't have reflux. I don't have arthritis. I've got a reduced risk of stroke because I've got a very strong family history for stroke, and also they need testosterone, so I'm happy about that. So I rely on the restriction every single time I eat. It controls the volume of food that I can consume, and now I have to stop and think before I eat. So that's similar to the lap band, but with the lap band, you know, if you pushed it too far, you'd just basically regurgitate whatever wouldn't go down and go again kind of thing if you needed to. Whereas now, full is full and there's nothing I can do about it. And I tend not to push it because it's just uncomfortable and I don't actually want to push it like I did perhaps with the band at times. So that's good. So I also rely on the lack of hunger. It's very rare that I actually do feel physically hungry. So I know that if I'm standing in a trance, looking into the fridge, I'm there for an emotional reason. And I stop and think before I impulsively eat, sort of like, wait a minute, what am I doing here kind of thing, because you know, it just puts that little stop and a little check into my day. So my poor old body has been through a lot, and I've put it through a lot. You know, with the drugs and with the food and with the weight, basically. But it's enabled me to have the child that I always wanted, and I'm really grateful for that. So I'm finding that it's difficult at the moment to exist without that shield of the fat, and I don't use fat in a negative way for anybody who's sort of fat positive or has issues with the use of that word. Being a healthy body weight is a great problem to have, even if I'm sort of struggling with it. So I caught myself checking myself out in an elevator with mirrors on all sides the other day, like a parrot, sort of, who's a pretty boy kind of thing, which was really, you know, uncommon behaviour for me. So I found that at 46, I'm the most content with my body that I've ever been, despite the, you know, wobbly bits and the wrinkly bits. And I can see muscles that I've never knew that I had now with a loss of weight. So it's early days, but I hope I can learn to respect and nourish my body, you know, instead of driving it like a car style, basically. Excellent. I really appreciate the service and the fellowship, and Footsteps especially, is just a great resource. And thanks for letting me share.